It is Monday evening, and I was hoping, was really, really hoping to be covering Game 6 of the NLCS between the Padres and the Phillies at Petco Park right now. And as much as I enjoy hanging out with you, Todd Strain, we might have been hanging out at Petco Park, but it would have been really cool to be covering that game. Now, regardless of whether or not it would have changed the ultimate outcome, obviously, you hope that the Padres make the comeback. Big ask, winning three straight against the hot Phillies team. But just to have another game at Petco Park, the atmosphere that would have greeted the team, that would have been fun.
I would much rather be at Petco Park than hanging out in my son's bedroom. I'd much rather be at Petco Park watching playoff baseball than hanging out in my son's bedroom doing the podcast. Yeah, it would have been cool to get it back to San Diego and just see that vibe one more time. Mm-hmm. As you said, who knows if they would have beat the Phillies three straight, but to get it back and see San Diego in that ballpark again, showing love for the Padres and vice versa. And you know what? I think if they would have got it back to San Diego, I think they're in a really good position, but heck, we'll never know.
Yeah, game six, you got all the momentum behind you, and then you force a game seven, you just never know. And they had some good pitching lined up, but that wasn't in the cards. So a lot to talk about on this episode of the On Fire podcast. I don't know if we want to refer to it as the first offseason episode. I feel like, you know, we didn't get a chance to do this Sunday, which we would have liked, you know, as we've referenced on this podcast and previous episodes. Sundays are hard days for us, and so we really wanted to do this. So apologies for the delay, but between football night and sports wrap and, you know, just buttoning things up on the Padres front as well, even though Derek Togerson was out in Philly, we had a lot on our hands. So unfortunately, unable to do that. So here we are to put a bow on the 2022 season. Before we do that, thanks to OGs, the sponsor of the On Fire podcast. Head to OGs.com, sign up, and download the OGs app. You can now visit your local OGs, eat pizza, drink beer, and earn rewards. OGs rewards available at select OGs locations. They're always launching new beers, four new ones, including the Hazy Go Crazy Hazy IPA. And who doesn't love a good hazy? Football, of course, is back. And now, Todd, I guess we're kind of like all in on football season. College basketball season coming up as well. The changing of the seasons, you know, is definitely upon us after Sunday. Touching down this football season at OGs has never looked better. You won't miss a live game when you're watching at OGs. They're going all out, all game, all season long. Time for the walk-up music. As always, we appreciate you checking out the On Fire podcast, brought to you by NBC7. I am Darnay Tripp. He is Todd Strain. You don't have the quarter zip a la the Manning brothers and Barack Obama tonight and Jim Nance, but looking dapper as always, the sweater over the button up. I would have thought you were on TV today the way you're looking. Of course, the folks listening to the podcast. If you want to see Todd Strain, head to the NBC7 YouTube page, NBC7 Sports Wrap page, or the streaming app. But Todd, always a pleasure to be in your presence.
Thanks for having me. Always enjoy joining the On Fire podcast. And of course, lots to talk about, as you mentioned, with the Padres wrapping up the NLCS, a super amazing series. I know we'll get into it. A super season, and then a lot of excitement building on the upcoming season. And so it's good to be a Padre fan right now. And it's good to be a journalist in San Diego that gets to follow this team, not just for this year, but what's ahead. Pretty exciting indeed.
I've often thought about it, the way that they kind of dominate our coverage, you know, one day, one week to the next, and particularly in the last month and change. When you take a step back and think, well, what it'd be like if this were 2017 and 2018, you know, and these teams aren't very good. And by July and August, you feel like the season's gotten away from you. That would be a bummer. It's not nearly as much fun as it is now when there is so much thirst and attention and interest in this team. And they have rewarded that interest by going all in and investing and bringing a winner to San Diego, which has been a lot of fun to watch. some combination of, like you mentioned, kind of a look back on how things played out the last couple of days. I don't know if I'm really ready to do like the off-season look ahead, who's staying, who's going. I'm sure Derek will have some thoughts on that. Hopefully we'll be able to do that on Thursday. Now, Tuesday, if you are listening to this, you know, Monday night, Tuesday morning, we will get a chance to hear from AJ Preller and Bob Melvin. So we'll have more to pass along at the very latest on Thursday, just based on what we hear from those guys. You know, obviously on the season that was, but looking ahead, a lot of big roster decisions. The Fernando Tatis Jr. situation, how he now fits back into this team that really came together, you know, and just had this great energy and personality and unity about it. How Fernando Tatis Jr. fits in, because he is such a dynamic personality and he has been kind of the spark plug for this team. And then there's, you know, the question just in terms of positionally, how does he fit with Ha-Sung Kim and the outfield mix? And there was maybe like a brief period of time in the last few weeks where we're thinking, you know, Trent Grisham, maybe it doesn't look so bad out there in center field. And then the way the Philly series went, easy to kind of pump the brakes on that. As good as he is defensively, you know, wasn't the guy that they needed him to be, and certainly wasn't the guy that he was in those first two rounds of the postseason. So some big, interesting questions to answer, and we'll have plenty of time to talk about that. So I don't want to spend too much time on that. But at the same time, you know, we've had so much time to digest and think about what happened Saturday and what happened Sunday. So some kind of combination of looking back and the what ifs, and also a bit of an eye ahead to the future, if any of that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. Most people, they want to talk here and now. They want a little Phillies dissection, our thoughts on the series, what went wrong, what could have been a little bit better. And then, as you said, there'll be plenty of time in the coming days for a bigger look at what's ahead. And I did have the over-under on us talking about Tatis position change at 7 minutes and 13 seconds into the podcast. So we're right on schedule.
I feel like we didn't really talk about it. We just brought it up as a potential topic.
Fair enough. You know what I mean? Well,
we don't need to dive into it, but you know, let's not act like it's not out there. And I've definitely seen some tweets about it, and that is going to be a big part of the conversation, but probably for another time, after, you know, in the immediate aftermath of just a fantastic playoff run. But, you know, it comes to a difficult end, and you know, there is that sliding scale of hope and expectations and what you consider a success. The great thing about it is, like, this season is a success, and you could say that even after the wild card series. Like, no matter what happens from this period forward, this season is a success. Just having got to that point, got to the NLDS and overcome what they overcame, and then you go and beat the Dodgers and you get more games at Petco Park and get a taste of what it's like to compete at that level. You know, we don't have to go through what we went through last year, just kind of dissecting what went terribly wrong. And I think one, you know, is going through some of the sound that Derek Togerson, Travis McKenzie, photojournalist for NBC7, gathered last night, and they spoke to Craig Stammen, and I forget exactly what the question was, but what struck me is he said it proved that last year was a fluke. And I thought really powerful, especially that, you know, that would be, you know, on Craig's mind at that moment. Last year hung around so much with this year's team and the psyche of the fan base, and doing what they did this year, you know, exercised that demon, got it out of their system. And now they look back and say, okay, that's not indicative of who we are. That's not who this group is. And they proved it this year. And I thought about this a little bit. My hope is that the success of this year echoes into next season the way the failures of last year hung over this year's team. And it definitely hung over in terms of the fan base. We felt it. We talked about it. It was kind of the lens through which we watched this season and some of the highs and lows. And it came up with the players, you know, while they were going through some of their struggles into September and August and all that. And you know, I think they probably felt it to a degree. And I'm sure once they got into the playoffs and did what they did, they kind of, you know, okay, that's now history. We don't have to think about that anymore. And my hope now for this team is that they can carry the momentum and the excitement and everything that they established this year and everything that they accomplished. And it just gives them a boost. It gives them a lift next season. And we're viewing it through that lens of what they accomplished and what they overcame, just like we kind of went through this year thinking about 2021 in the back of our minds.
100%. The way this year played out, it resembled 2 years ago much more than the previous season. Last year was kind of the outlier, which as you're looking to build this team out and build this franchise for years to come is a very positive sign. If the Padres had laid another egg, then we would have had the complete opposite reaction where we knew, you know, that COVID season was the outlier. So some things you touched on, I mean, both this season was a huge success and the NLCS can be a huge disappointment. Both things can be true. You don't have to be one or the other. The season was an enormous success. The Padres, as you said, laid a foundation, took another step. They had players that had breakthrough seasons, Ha-Seong Kim, Jurickson Profar played great. Their pitching staff was healthy and among the best in baseball from the starter's perspective. Josh Hader regained his groove. So wonderful things in the regular season, a huge success that, as you said, can carry over and you can build on. And I think they have the small issues that they have are just that, small issues. They don't have any huge glaring holes. They had a lot of questions that were answered this year. And I touched on a few of those. They shored up the back end of their bullpen. Ha-Seong Kim is an everyday player. So yes, huge success. And as you said, once you start winning in Major League Baseball, that's you get comfortable. You have a franchise, you know how to win. Like the Dodgers, like the Braves, like the Yankees, sustained success, sustained excellence. And I think the Padres are entering that phase for the next few years here.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, there's been so many conversations today in the newsroom just about the team and what next year looks like and all that. And I think while there are, you know, big questions to be answered, does Jurickson Profar opt out?
Yeah.
Obviously, the Tatis situation, Josh Bell, Brandon Drury. You know, what happens with those guys? Sean Manaea, Mike Clevenger, what happens with those guys? Those four, I mean, you could all bring back on like prove it type deals if you wanted.
Yeah.
I would think on, you know, a fairly team friendly salary. Robert Suarez, another one of those types of guys that has the opportunity to opt out. Nick Martinez as well. And so there's like the surefire free agent types. Like, do you bring Clevenger, Manaea, Bell, Drury back, or who among those do you bring back? Then there's the Profars, Martinez, Suarez's of the world. What do those guys decide to do? Do they stay here, but, you know, potentially make a little bit more money, which they've all earned. But you look up and down the roster, it's like those core pieces are still there. And you mentioned Hader. I mean, this is the first time really since like 2019, you can maybe say 2020, but then Kirby got hurt where you're like, okay, we got a ninth inning guy, potentially have your setup guy in Suarez. You've got Manny there. You've got Joe there. You've got Blake and you there. You've got Tatis coming back. You've got Soto. So there's a lot of, you know, that core, that foundation is still there, and it's a really strong and now accomplished foundation that knows what it's like to deal with the ups and downs of a 162 game season together as a unit, weather some of those storms and do what they did. And, you know, with AJ Preller's creativity and always spotting, you know, favorable deals and, you know, just creative ways to stockpile talent and fill holes. You know, it makes you confident, just like getting Manaea the way that they did, getting Taylor Rogers and eventually Josh Hader the way that they did, getting Brandon Drury the way that they did. Like, this is a guy that you can trust on to like help fill some of those gaps in the rotation, first base, outfield, potentially catcher, what have you. And I would think that Peter Seidler is going to be aggressive and willing to spend, especially after what they did this year. And I would guess more opportunities to make some money with crowds at Petco Park when they're not even playing games there, you know, like we saw during the NLCS and all that. So it's very interesting. And you know, bodes well. And here we are already doing like our first offseason episode. We're discussing all that. I feel like we should kind of get to the Phillies series, but all these things, I mean, you can't help but kind of like have an eye ahead, you know, now having 24 hours to kind of digest what happened in Philly.
Yeah. I mean, big ups to Seidler. He paid a huge amount, more than any Padre owner in previous years, in player salaries. And to keep this team where we want them to be moving forward, he's going to have to commit a little more money, which he seems he's not going to break the bank. They're not going to sign a huge free agents, but to round out the roster on the edges, he's going to have to commit a little more money, which he seems open to doing. If he doesn't, then that we'll have to take stock of that. And as you said, AJ Preller has proven himself. You can second guess some deals and everything like that, but he has proven himself. When you're talking about the edges of the roster, he can go find guys like Manaea, like Cronenworth, that will help round it out and solidify those question marks that the Padres have, which you said they're question marks on the edges. They're not major keystone question marks. So the Padres are in a very good spot. And as you said, we're already talking next season, but because the Padres were in such a good spot this postseason, I'm still hung up. And as much as I say it's a wonderful season and excited, to me, the NLCS is still a missed opportunity because they had a team and they had a roster with home field advantage in the NLCS. I mean, the Phillies played great. But in postseason baseball, it's so finicky and the margins are so slim. And I really thought this Padres team had a chance to get it done, at least advancing to the World Series.
I'm surprised. I did not expect a team to win three straight.
No.
In Philadelphia. You know, going there with the split, I would have bet $100 that we were going to see a game six at Petco Park. I just didn't think that was happening for either team, as even as it seemed those first couple games. And it was still fairly even throughout. You know, maybe you could say game four, it just felt... Yeah, I mean, that's even hard to say because the Padres had the lead, what, in the fifth inning, and, you know, they strike early, and but the way that the Phillies were hitting the ball, it just felt like it was going to be a challenge to get 27 outs and get through that lineup without them doing damage. But all competitive ball games, and you know, you can have a really competitive series that ends in five games.
100%.
That's the nature of sports. Every game in a vacuum could have gone either way, but the Phillies just, I don't want to say got the breaks. In some cases, they got the breaks, but made some of their own breaks as well. And our buddy Artie Ojeda here at the station, I think, was a little annoyed because I said, well, they lost the better team. And I think he took it as me saying, like, Phillies on paper just clearly better than the Padres. That I don't believe. I just mean, in terms of the way the series played out, the Phillies played better. Their top two and even three, Suarez, they were really good. And the top of their lineup was absolutely deadly. Those guys mashed and they handled the bullpen game better. And you could say Rob Thompson, you know, outmanaged Bob Melvin. Now, if you run it back and start from scratch 10 times, it's probably 5-5, maybe 6-4 in favor of one or the other. But as it played out, for whatever reason, the Phillies just seemed to be the hotter team, the more dangerous team, and that makes them scary. Now, for Houston going into the World Series, there was just a different fear factor. Maybe it's because we're watching from a Padres slant, but a different kind of fear factor whenever you got to Kyle Schwarber through certainly Bryce Harper, maybe even Nick Castellanos, that I don't know that you necessarily felt with the Padres, you know, as much as... Yeah. Manny had his moments and Soto back-to-back games with homers. That Philly lineup was terrifying. And you could even see it in the way Yu Darvish was pitching to some of those guys. I mean, he was nibbling a little bit more than Yu Darvish tends to nibble. Now, he didn't seem to have his best stuff on Sunday, but you didn't feel like you could just attack those guys because of what they showed themselves capable of doing throughout the course of the series.
Yeah, I think if you talk to most baseball experts and people who really watch a lot of MLB baseball, most people would pick the Padres lineup. They would pick the Padres roster. But when you get into postseason baseball, as we found out against the Mets and the Dodgers, it's which team is playing better and which team is playing hotter. And as you said, the Phillies' big three, Schwarber, Hoskins and Harper mashed. They hit much better in this series than any Machado, Soto, and whoever you want to throw in as the Padres third hitter, you know, Bell, Drury, whoever. Phillies out hit them at the bottom of the order. The Padres bottom of the order was not good against the Phillies. As we know, they were excellent against the Mets and Dodgers. The Phillies bottom of the order outperformed the Padres. So when you're losing the offensive stats there, you're losing the series. And as you said, the Phillies, you know, starting pitching somewhat of a wash. You could probably give it outside of Darvish. The Phillies had better starting pitching. So the Phillies won the series. They played great. Their stars hit better than the Padres. The bottom of the order hit better. And as you said, there are some key plays, swing managerial decisions on key plays that played out in the Phillies' favor. You could argue round and round whether Melvin made those decisions incorrectly or correctly. I'm a guy who sees both sides. I can kind of see both sides on that one. But those are decisions, and sometimes they play out. And every single decision seemed to play out in the Phillies' favor. And you just got to tip your hat to them. The thing that jumps out to me is just the bottom of the order. That was a difference against the Dodgers. Grisham didn't hit. Nola didn't hit. Kim hit a little, but I think two of his hits were in one game. The 7-9 hit 0.093 in the NLCS. Real tough to win when you're doing that.
Yeah. I feel like we got to talk about the Saturday situation and, you know, the Grisham deal, you know, bunting in the ninth with two on.
Yeah.
Josh Hader not pitching to Bryce Harper. I got just eviscerated Saturday by saying that the reliever situation wasn't on Bob Melvin, which is probably a foolish thing to say. I got caught up in the moment. JT Realmuto just homered off Steven Wilson. I just felt like whoever was stepping to the mound was just was serving them up.
You
know, obviously Bob Melvin deserves, you know, some blame, responsibility, however you want to call it, for the way things Saturday played out. What I do go back to is the way the Phillies were hitting. I just felt like it was going to be really tough to get 27 outs once Mike Clevinger flamed out the way that he did. The Manaea situation, maybe you stick to one inning with Manaea. But even if with it being a 6-4 game, Luis Garcia gave up a homer. Okay, now it's 6-5. That's a guy that you are going to see at some point. Steven Wilson gave up a homer. That's a guy that, you know, potentially you see regardless. Maybe you get two from Suarez and Hader, you know, Hill and Pierce Johnson had pitched the night before. So I just think it was going to be an uphill climb, even though they did have the lead, just the way the Phillies were swinging the bat that night. And look, Clevinger in his start against the Dodgers went 2 2/3 and gave up 4 runs. It's not a good start. If he had done that against the Phillies, the Padres might win the game.
Yeah.
If he gets through 2 2/3 and then you hand it over to Nick Martinez and he gets you close to the six, maybe even to the six, and then you're able to go, you know, Garcia, Suarez, Hader, you probably win that game. But the fact that he didn't record a single out and then you're having to go to Nick Martinez and then make up all that ground, I just think it gets really, really difficult. And I'll run the risk of defending the Sean Manaea situation. Sean Manaea's last two appearances, 10 innings, 1 earned run. One of those appearances came against the Dodgers. Now, this was a long time ago. This was, you know, during the regular season. So the rebuttal would be, if he were pitching so well, we probably would have seen him at some point against the Mets, against the Dodgers, maybe earlier in the Phillies series. So they must have known something that they weren't completely comfortable with. But the velocity was up. You know, Bob Melvin had some favorable things to say, and Bob Melvin's always going to kind of defend his guys. But he could have played that differently. I'm not convinced that the result changes on Saturday night. And if you start Nick Martinez, he only, if memory serves, he only saw that top of the Phillies order once.
Yeah.
He didn't have to start the game against those guys. Bryce Harper was always already on third.
Yes.
And good on him getting out of that jam. But he didn't have to see those guys right out of the gates. And so it also just kind of changes who's coming in, where, who they're running into. Everybody's saying, hey, 6 2/3 of, you know, two earned runs or whatever, and it was all in Manaea and Clevinger. I don't count Adrian Morejon's inning. It was 10-6 at that point. Given what we saw in the Mets series, do you trust Adrian Morejon in a high leverage situation if it's a tie game or a one run game? No, you don't. So there's certainly a compelling argument to be made against the way Bob Melvin managed the situation. And but I just think once Clevinger did what he did, and maybe you shouldn't have started him in the first place if you know that he's banged up. But once that happened, I just think it got really, really difficult. The Manaea situation obviously didn't help. But I think, especially now that Suarez comes in fresh, does give up that homer to Bryce Harper, it's just no guarantee that all the guys that you think should have pitched were going to get through that lineup unscathed. The way that the Phillies were playing, I just find that to be a little bit unlikely. And so I think my issue more so, and the fact is it almost played out in their favor. I mean, if Suarez pitches two innings and gets through Bryce Harper, then you're thinking, well, thank goodness he was fresh. And then you're going into a game six and a game seven. But obviously the way things play out, you know, it determines how you feel about the decisions that were made. In this case, there were mistakes made on Saturday, and certainly I think you'd say mistakes made on Sunday as well.
Yeah, but before we get into Sunday, because there's a lot there, just Saturday, the pitching decisions, it's not like Bob Melvin had a lot of great options. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and as you said, the Phillies were mashing that day. No matter who got in there from that Padre bullpen, I mean, the Phillies were clearly hitting that day. There weren't a lot of great options for me. Somebody come to me and said, sure, you could have argued with who starts, who this, but somebody from that Padre bullpen was going to have to step up and get some Philly batters out. And nobody did. The other thing is, Bob Melvin trusted his guys in that game. He trusted Clevinger. You know, they don't just make the decision blindly. They talked to Clevinger. He felt better. They thought he was going to give him more than he did. He trusted his guys. He trusted Sean Manaea. As you mentioned, you said his last 10 innings, how well he had pitched. Nick Martinez had not thrown more than three innings in an extensive amount of time. I think it goes back to July.
So yeah, July was the last time he had thrown more than 40 pitches, and he threw 43 on Saturday.
So Melvin trusted his guys. He did the same thing in the previous series, two series. He trusted Grisham, and Grisham delivered for him. So I have no problem with Melvin trusting his guys. Like, it works with Grisham. It works with Nola in the previous series. This series, he trusts his pitching staff, his guys. It doesn't work. That's postseason baseball, and that we can argue. And as I said, I see both sides. But if I'm a manager, if I'm on a team, or if I'm a player and I'm on a team, and we're all trusting each other and we're all believing in each other, I mean, maybe that trust is misguided, some people say. But I think Melvin's trust got them to that point, what he did in previous series. So he was trusting his guys again. And if the result is that because he trusted his guys and he believes in his team and there's no other options, like, that's a result I'll live with. Because I don't think there was a better option. I mean, you could argue, as I said, how you were gonna slate those relievers and stagger them, but there's not a foolproof option there.
And he trusts Josh Hader, you know, after the Royals blow up, he throws him in, what was it, against the Giants, and that's what kind of got him back in a groove. And so the situation that have caused fans some frustration and some disappointment with how Bob Melvin has handled things, I mean, it's just the same. His MO has also provided some great moments and has benefited the team on occasion. And I think now we kind of get Bob Melvin, right? And so we know what to expect in terms of how he navigates some of these situations, and he's going to stay true to who he is and his MO. And sometimes it's going to work and it got help get them to this point. And other times it's not going to pan out. And that was kind of how things went over the weekend. And Bob Melvin, you know, he's a guy with a lot of conviction. He is who he is. And I think that steadiness is part of, you know, it's resonated with the team. I think it's benefited the team. There just being no uncertainty about the guy that's kind of calling the shots. And so it's an admirable characteristic, but it's not always going to work out for you. And in a similar vein, it doesn't surprise me that Bob Melvin would stick with Robert Suarez in that situation against Bryce Harper rather than changing script and going against how he usually plays things out by bringing in his closer in what was essentially an eighth inning close. I mean, people in baseball talk about the close doesn't always happen in the ninth inning.
Yeah.
And with the top of the order, you know, up in the eighth, that was the close situation. But Bob Melvin is a guy that seems to have defined roles, defined expectations, the defined script Derek talks about all the time, managing from the ninth inning forward. And he just doesn't seem like the type of guy that's going to say, you know, let me flip flop everything, you know, for this one situation. And, you know, then run the risk of putting yourself in jeopardy late in the ninth. I mean, there's a very real situation where, you know, they put Hader in. He's got to get him through the eighth. He gets through Harper, but then they get down to the bottom of the order. And, you know, can Hader get you six outs? I don't know about that. They're probably going to have to bring somebody else in the ninth. What if they get back up to Kyle Schwarber? So it's another situation where the way it plays out influences what we all say and how we grade the situation. But again, faith in his guy, Robert Suarez, had earned that faith. And you can say lefty on lefty and all that. As Melvin mentioned, Robert Suarez hadn't allowed a homer to a lefty all season long. And so there is reason to have some faith in him. He's done the two inning thing before. And again, defined roles, defined expectations. I think that's that, from my observation, that seems to be a Bob Melvin thing. And so I'm not surprised that he stuck with his guns in that situation. A really interesting, and I want to make sure I have this right. Austin Nola talked about the Bryce Harper at bat, and you could tell Nola took it really, really hard, you know, as the catcher. He feels like, oh, I could I've done something differently, you know, is that on me? And like, you know, Austin Nola, the consummate teammate, but they're
talking about the 1-2 change up that just missed, right? And then and then the fastball.
So 1-2 count, foul ball on a four seamer, then a sinker. And then they dial up a change up, bottom of the zone that clipped the strike zone, and it's called ball two. And Nola was shocked that Bryce Harper laid off of it. I mean, they seemed certain that they're one way or another, they're going to get a strike. They could get him fooled on the changeup, get him to swing out in front of it. And so then it seems like Harper, once he saw that and dodged that bullet, he's like, okay, I know I'm getting a fastball now. He got the sinker and he did what he did. And, you know, another one that's out of the zone or on the other half of the zone as a lefty, just like the one he hit off Darvish, which was, you know, not a bad pitch. It was outside of the zone, but Bryce Harper's really, really good right now and he can make you pay. And you know, it's those situations are really, really tough. There's a lot that would indicate that they played that well. They didn't get the called third strike. They didn't fool Bryce Harper. And then he did what really good hitters do. And he did something that hadn't happened against Robert Suarez all season. It wasn't like one of these obvious, like, how could you not see that? Obviously, just watching it, you could be like, how could you not see Bryce Harper would hit a home run in that situation? But when you really break it down, it's like, it's pretty amazing that he did what he did there, because the Padres didn't necessarily play it poorly in terms of the way Suarez and Nola handled that at bat.
Yeah. I think it's easy to hop on Twitter or call talk radio and fire off Bob Melvin blew that situation, should have brought in Hader. But you walked us through why they made that decision to keep Suarez in and pitch to him. And Melvin said he was trying to get to Hader for a four out situation. So he wasn't adverse to bringing in Hader in the eighth. He wanted to get Hader to a four out situation. Now, the flip side is of that, there is, I mean, I see both sides. You got Josh Hader for these moments. Bryce Harper is a left-handed batter. Hader is nasty on lefties. You said it before. The close situation always isn't in the ninth inning. This was the game. The Phillies, a generational talent up. Bring your best guy. Mano a mano. We need to win this game or our season's over.
Yeah.
Your logic and how the Padres explain walking through that inning makes perfect sense. the other argument makes sense to me too. That's baseball. I mean, that's it. And as you said, you just got to tip your cap to Bryce Harper. He had an amazing at bat and he took Suarez over and out. You could have brought in Josh Hader, and Hader could have made miraculous pitches as well. And Bryce Harper is such a good hitter. He could have taken Hader out of the ballpark. It's sports. That was an awesome moment. You can argue either side. We can hit Twitter. We can send our tweets in all capitals. We can do whatever we want. And that's sports. That's it. We get to talk about it. In Philly, they get to remember that moment, how awesome it is. We get the agony. It's tough to deal with when you have some other options, and one of those options involves the big nasty Hader down in the pen. So, I feel bad bashing Melvin for a move that you can logically see why they played it that way.
I was just out of curiosity. Robert Suarez throwing his changeup against lefties this year. Did it 125 times. Opponent average of 103. Opponent slugging percentage of 138. Whiff percentage over 35%.
Yeah.
It's a darn good pitch this year against lefties. And they just didn't win in that situation. And maybe it should have been a called strike. But strategically, it seemed to be a good move. But, I mean, you're absolutely 100% right in that it stings to not see. I can say everything I did about the way Saturday played out and the way Sunday played out. It sucks that Josh Hader did not get a chance to pitch.
100%.
And if you could pick him up and plug him into any number of those situations, you're like, that probably plays out differently. 100%. And so there's no way around it. I'm not having Josh Hader, you know, your deadliest reliever in that situation, especially when it's a lefty. That's a bummer.
And postseason baseball moves fast, even in 7-game series. As you said, you go to Philly and you think for sure the series is coming back to San Diego, but you lose a close one in Game 3. Game 4 is a wild one. So you really never had a perfect situation for Hader. And all of a sudden you're facing elimination. And if you don't throw him, he basically had one chance to get him in the game. Was that at bat against Harper? And then the at bat doesn't go your way, and all of a sudden you're being second guessed for never getting Hader in the series on games 3, 4, and 5. You know, but then I look back to the Dodgers series, and Suarez came up huge in that series.
Yeah.
On multiple occasions against very good hitters in situations that were high leverage with runners on base. Yeah. So, you know. Just that, shake your head.
Yeah, I mean, Suarez was, I mean, you talk about like the most valuable Padres during the postseason. Yeah. Suarez is in the top 3, top 5.
Well, you talked about opting out. He's got a $5 million player option. I see no way where after the season he had and the postseason he had that he doesn't opt out and get huge bucks. So that'll be a really hard player for the Padres to retain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could have ended up in a situation where the way the Phillies played it backfired on them, you know, taking Suarez out when they did on Friday. Now they are able to use him for the close on Sunday, taking Wheeler out when they did on Sunday, having to rely on Alvarado and Sir Anthony Dominguez the way they did on Friday. Yeah. And, you know, going into the bullpen game, you know, there was a chance if it played out in the Padres' favor where they're stacked up better than the Phillies are going into Game 6 and Game 7. But things don't necessarily play out the way that you would like.
Hey, now that you've had a little more time, a couple days, the Grisham bunt, and you've heard the talk with Melvin, they huddled and they thought this might be the way to go. Now, where I see both sides on many things in this Phillies series and how it played out, I do not see that. I think you have a runner on second base. You have one out. You have two outs to get a single and get him home. Bunting for a base hit to then hopefully have a sacrifice to me is not your best option. I want my guys hitting for base hits to drive in the winning run. Of course, if there's no outs, that's much different. Get them over to third. Mm-hmm. But I want my guys hitting and trying to knock in those runs rather than bunting for a base hit. And then
as good a bunter as Trent Grisham is.
as good of a bunter as Trent Grisham is. And I have no qualms with not pinch hitting for Grisham. You know, there's a lot of talk for Alfaro. Get him up there. I mean, you rolled with Grisham. You showed confidence in him. Let him swing the bat, try to get a hit, and then you got another AB to drive in your guy. Because the Phillies bullpen, as you said, how they managed it, they were in a little bit of a shaky situation. I feel like you just gave them a free out when they needed two outs to win that game. You gave them 50% of those.
Yeah. If you get two guys that can swing freely, two opportunities to get the base hit with a man at second, I prefer that situation than the way things played out. And executing that bunt in that situation, I mean, that's asking a lot. And like you said, you're kind of giving away an out there. I think, you know, a lot of people, and I asked people on Twitter, and, you know, there's a lot of people saying, yes, let me see Alfaro, given what he did during the regular season. Yeah. And he was so clutch on so many occasions. That's where, you know, here's another critique of Bob Melvin. You didn't get him an at-bat at any point during the postseason. Yeah. And, you know, maybe during game one or game three against the Mets. I'm trying to think of other games that kind of got away, you know, maybe game two against the Phillies, you know, if you're in these eighth, ninth inning situations where you feel kind of comfortable with where you're at, you know, if you can sneak a guy in at bat in there, so he's not in this situation where he would be coming in completely cold, having not hit since whenever it was, you know, at the end of the regular season, then I understand the apprehension about putting him in there to kind of save your season when he is he's cold, when he's completely cold and has that be his first chance. He hadn't had a chance to settle into kind of the postseason stage. I think that's asking a lot. And I would have, as much as anybody, I love Jorge Alfaro. I would have loved to have seen him in that situation. You have all the faith in the world, especially if it's in the regular season and he's in more of a groove. But that part is disappointing. Just the
It would have been fun, Darnay, to see LFGSD up there in a key moment. Like, that would have been fun. It would have been awesome for Padre Nation. And because of how Padre fans feel about Alfaro, there wouldn't have been much second guessing. Like, they would have understood the decision. And it would have been fun. But I'm with you. I don't know if that was the
But I do think people, if he grounds into a double player, strikes out, I think people are saying, well, what'd you expect? He hasn't hit since a regular season. So I think there would be some criticism regardless. My fear with Trent Grisham is like, just don't ground into a double. But now he's got good speed. And so, you know, it's not necessarily an easy turn. But I think that was my fear. Like, one out, you ground into a game ending double play. And so maybe there's part of me that could say, okay, well, the bunt's not ideal, but you know, moves everybody a little bit closer. I don't know. You know, also they did go ahead on a wild pitch. And so maybe you bring that into play by getting somebody over to the third. So it's, you know, it was one of those situations where,
I go at it like this, kind of, you know, when football teams are, you know, at the 18 yard line and it's fourth and two. And if you're the team that's on defense and you're a fan of that team, you're like, oh yeah, just kick the field goal. We'll give up the 3 points. Don't go for it. Don't go for it on fourth down. I feel like that if the Padres would have went to the Phillies and said, hey, do you want a swinging twice? These two batters trying to get a hit, or do you want a bunt and then down to one batter? The Phillies would have said, oh, go ahead, lay down a bunt and we'll take one batter to end the game.
Yeah. That's a great point.
I kind of feel like that's how I view that situation.
Sorry, such a drag. Such a drag.
A drag bunt, dude.
Well, and Will Myers strikes out to start that inning on a pitch that was low and away. According to ESPN, it was in the zone, but I had a tough time believing that. But, you know, they, and it kind of, well, I don't want to equate it. You know, when Jerks and Profar got thrown out the night before, you feel like, oh, there goes any shot of a rally, yeah. You know,
yeah.
You get an out and then you get kind of the momentum taken away from you and the crowd's all into it. And you have kind of that deflating moment. You just wanted a little more juice in that situation. Yeah. And Trent Grisham had hit a ball hard, you know, I think in that game, his previous at bat sent one
To the warning track.
Yeah. He flew out to right. And so while he hadn't, you know, logged an actual hit, you know, I hadn't done anything necessarily. That maybe that's where Bob Melvin didn't trust his guys. You know, maybe that's counter to Bob Melvin's MO, and maybe he deserves some flack for not saying, yeah, Trent, we're not going to manage scared. We've seen you get a big hit in these spots during the postseason. We think you can do it again. Go swing away. But they did the conservative play and it ended up being kind of the dumb play. It didn't work out the way they wanted to. And it left, you know, it's one thing if you're doing that and then Juan Soto's coming up or Manny Machado's coming up, but then you're putting a lot on Austin Nola's plate and he did fly out. And so maybe there's the sack fly that you're looking for if they do get a guy on third with one out. But that's putting a lot on Austin Nola's plate. While he's just got to sit there and watch the guy just kind of in front of him giving out away.
Yeah. Well, that's why I think this is such a frustrating NLCS and a missed opportunity, because as we've talked about all the time, the margins in this series, even though it was 4-1, are very close. And as we see in postseason baseball, you want to go into the postseason with three starting pitchers healthy and having great seasons. The Padres had three pitchers, Musgrove, Snell, and Darvish, all throwing great, all healthy. Not all those guys are always healthy in the last few years. So this kind of lined up for them. They had Josh Hader at the peak of his powers. They had Suarez at the back end of the bullpen to help him out. They had a guy who could eat innings, Nick Martinez. They had Soto, even though he underperformed. You had your lineup outside of, you know, most of the postseason hitting the ball. You had Drury and Bell in the lineup. We don't know if those guys will be in the lineup on the team next year. Everything kind of lined up. Like, this was an opportunity. So many things went right for them to get to this point where, as we've seen with the Dodgers year after year, it's hard in the postseason baseball to have everything line up and get to this point. So will the Padres have three healthy frontline starting pitchers next year in the postseason? No matter how great their regular season is, who knows? That's why it's just a downer, because I feel like it was there and it just didn't come through as we thought it would.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, people are saying, well, they need more in the rotation, which is true. But at the same time, I mean, their top three was as good, if not better, than the Phillies' top three. Zach Wheeler was probably the best pitcher of the series. Yu Darvish was the second best pitcher of the series.
Yeah.
Then it was probably, you can make a case somewhere in there is Ranger Suarez, what he did on Friday. But it's, you know, Joe Musgrove, Blake Snell, the way he grinded through that game and got over that tough second inning. So it's like both teams had a good top three. The Phillies didn't have a fourth starter.
No.
And Falter got lit up on Saturday, but the bullpen performed better, managed a bit better on Saturday. And, the back end guys Friday night and Sunday. And that was kind of the difference. So it's like, on one hand, yes, you do want like a fourth guy that you can rely on, but it's not like the Phillies had. They just for the most part, their bullpen just performed better.
No, and I mean, where are the Padres getting this fourth guy? They had Mackenzie Gore. They dealt Gore to get Soto. So you could have had a fourth starter, but you wouldn't have had Juan Soto. You wouldn't have had Bell. There's not unlimited money next year. You can't just go out and get $100 million free agent pitcher. So a four starter in the postseason is a luxury. That's very, very rare.
Yeah.
And have a dependable power four starter.
And we, you know, it could have caused a lot of teams trouble with the compressed schedule. They didn't have the day off between Philly and then coming back to San Diego potentially if they had. Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, I think the Padres are going to be able to figure that part out. It's just, yeah, they got into the situation where Mike Clevinger wasn't himself, Sean Manaea wasn't himself. And if one of those guys were, again, going back to Saturday, if one of those guys were right and you're like, okay, they can get us through four innings and give up two runs, you win that game on Saturday. You just do, because then they would have had a clear advantage over Philly. And we talked about it, like thinking Syndergaard was going to start, like, how's that going to go? And in actuality, both guys that started that game were pretty bad, but Philly's just navigated it better than the Padres.
Yeah. And it's, and we talked about, I think, in one of the earlier podcasts, the seven game series do present a more of an opportunity to see holes within your roster for postseason construction. Whereas those shorter series, three games, five games, they don't show those holes. So seven game series can sometimes shine a light where you don't want that light to shine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're sitting in the seats in the Padres auditorium, level floor at level four at Petco Park, that we've gotten very acclimated to during this postseason run, pregame, postgame, all that. AJ Preller and Bob Melvin are at the podium. You wave for the mic. Hey, over here, over here. What question do you want to ask one or both of those guys?
I'm going to ask AJ, who makes the decision on what position Tatis will play next year? Is that a decision AJ Preller is making, or will Fernando Tatis Jr. have any input in that decision? And I think that's a huge decision because it'll shape not only next year, but all the moves you're going to make for whatever is remaining on Tatis. What is it, 12, 13 years on the contract? And I know what where Tatis wants to play. He wants to play shortstop. I'm not sure the Padres organization would like him at shortstop. So it'll be interesting to see if they're going to make that decision themselves or if they're going to give him some input and kind of bow to his wishes, because that will shape so many decisions moving forward with who plays first base, who plays center field, who plays left field, et cetera, and what you're going to do with Kim, Cronenworth, et cetera.
Yeah.
What's your question? What's your question?
Yeah, I mean, it'd probably be along the same lines because, I mean, you know, I'm curious what happens with Will Myers. He was asked about it, if there's a situation where he could come back, and he said, yeah, there's, I forget exactly how he put it, but they're open to anything or what have you. But that's obviously not of utmost importance in terms of the trajectory of the franchise.
It's important if you want a shot or a beer downtown, though.
That's true. Right. After there a playoff victory.
Yes.
It's got to be Tatis because, you know, they made the sexy splashes during the trade deadline. I would guess that the moves, you know, maybe with a Wilson Contreras or somebody, a catcher, but I would guess that that's probably about as juicy as it gets this offseason, that it's more so kind of rounding out the roster, those outfield spots, first base, maybe catcher, the rotation. So I guess we went into last offseason expecting like that huge splash. I don't necessarily know that that will be the case this year. But the Tatis situation, I mean, it has to be. I think if you ask 100 people, I would think 94 would say some question related to Fernando Tatis Jr. And yeah, like, what's the plan? Where is he being used? Is he getting acclimated to those spots? What is he doing right now? It's all of that. What sense have you gotten in terms of his willingness to go play elsewhere? Because that is such a huge domino effect, you know? If he's in center field, and then you got, you know, potentially Profar and Soto on the other side, then it's what happens at first base. There was also with all the talk when Hosmer was here of, well, just play Jake Cronenworth at first and Ha-Seong Kim at second and Fernando Tatis short and Manny Machado at third, which makes a lot of sense. Ha-Sung Kim's just so darn good at shortstop. He's got a good arm, you know, and not that he would be wasted at second base. He'd obviously still be very valuable there. But he's just, you know, he's just proven it. And so, I don't know. It, like I said, so much hinges on kind of that situation, but I think that's, and I doubt we get a good answer October 25th. I don't think that's coming, but maybe gives us some hint at what the offseason looks like. Because that's something he would obviously need to get a lot of work at, you know, however that looks, just, you know, a fly ball machine, you know, or, you know, something that's a little bit less predictable with somebody at the plate, just kind of hitting to him out in center so he can get a feel for it and make his reads and that sort of thing. But what do they want, and what does Fernando Tatis Jr. want, and where do those things intersect? Because I don't think they've always, those things haven't always kind of met. And now they're in this situation where, you know, how much say does Fernando Tatis Jr. have slash deserve after everything that's happened? You'd think they're in a spot where the franchise could kind of dictate terms a little bit more. Yes. But that's got to be question 1A, 1B, 1C, 1D, you know, the Fernando Tatis Jr. situation, just given his importance to the franchise and how that impacts Trent Grisham, how that impacts, if you do keep him in the infield, you know, then it's less necessary to bring back a Josh Bell, you know, but if he's in the outfield, you know, and you have a glaring weakness or glaring hole there at first base, they're like, okay, Will Myers, Josh Bell, one of those guys, Brandon Drury, you definitely want to bring one of them back. So it's super important question.
I think the lineup with the most upside, if you're building a Padres super team, and it's also the riskiest move, is to move Tatis to the outfield, to center field, because then you keep Ha-Sung Kim at shortstop. You keep Jake Cronenworth at second base, two guys that are gold glovers. Sure, your defense takes a little hit in center field with Grisham or with Tatis, but you got to believe he can learn to play the position better. And center field is negligible. I mean, in a regular baseball season, the center fielder defensive, you know, your win ratio is not too huge. Postseason baseball, different story. But then you can first base. You have some options. Whether it's Drury, Bell, or Myers on a team friendly deal, which I would think the chances for one of those guys returning on a team friendly deal would be high. And there's also, you can find a first baseman a little bit easier than some other positions. To me, that is a super team. Trent Grisham has shown, despite what he did against the Dodgers and the Mets, he is not a positive everyday player offensively. He's been trending down for multiple years. He's awesome. Awesome on defense. But if you're really looking to elevate this Padre team to the next level, and the organization has some, as you say, some control of the Tatis situation, some ability to kind of dictate the terms to him, that's the move that makes the Padres' potential as a super team possible. The shortstop makes him better, and you can see how it play out with Cronenworth at first and Kim at second, and you're fine with Grisham in center field. But I don't think that moves the needle as much. And I think if you ask, I always come back to this, if you ask other teams what move do you not want to see the Padres make, it would probably be move Tatis to center field.
Yeah. And, you know, I think people like to make it about this is a Tatis versus Ha-Sung Kim conversation. No, it's a Ha-Sung Kim versus Trent Grisham conversation. They're both gold glovers. One of them produces more consistently for you offensively and is probably 100%. The best base runner on the team. And so who do you want to stay put, Trent Grisham or Ha-Sung Kim? Probably Ha-Sung Kim. And we've seen, they haven't all been perfect, but we've seen different guys produce at first base. Luke Voit did some good things. Will Myers did some good things. Josh Bell did some good things. Brandon Drury. How many of those guys are like everyday guys that you feel comfortable with? I don't know. That's a different question. But how many center fielders have the Padres seen in recent years that both offensively, defensively can produce in some sort of way? That is a very, very short list. And I don't know how it does include Trent Grisham to a degree, but he's obviously left a lot to be desired. So in a sense, it feels a little bit easier to find a serviceable first baseman than it is a guy that checks all the boxes in center field. And, you know, you want a first baseman that can slug and hit for power. Well, if your center fielder is doing it the way that Fernando Tatis Jr. does it, then it's not quite as crucial because you got a 40 homer guy, 1,000 OPS guy already in your lineup.
Yeah. And if Tatis comes back to shortstop, all of a sudden you're changing shortstop, second base, and first baseman have new positions from this previous season that we talked about that gave them so much juice and momentum and where they played well. Whereas if you move Tatis to center field, everyone pretty much stays the same. You only have one positional change in those everyday spots.
It's like when an offensive lineman gets hurt, you know, like, well, exactly. Let's not shuffle all these guys around. Let's just fix that one spot and, you know, not have the entire chain kind of get thrown off. Very good point by you, Todd Strain. Yeah.
Well, Kim got so much better defensively and more consistent, but then he started hitting better, much better after, I think it was June or July. I mean, his numbers were much better. He's still not awesome at the bat, but he's much better. And a lot of that offensive growth, I'm sure, comes from being more comfortable defensively and feeling that he's really part of the team and that he earned his spot, like in any job. Whether if you get the vibe from your coworkers that you're important and they like you and you're seeing some success in some other areas of your job, there are going to be some uptick in some different areas where maybe you're not so confident. So to me, that's right.
And he's just beloved. You know, he's obviously Manny's boy and the guys really like him.
Yeah.
Well, this has been good. It's been fun to kind of get all our thoughts out there and you know, just kind of bat these things back and forth. I feel like I hadn't had a good opportunity to just digest everything we saw the last few days. And so nice to get a chance to do that and to just kind of take a glimpse ahead at what's to come. Like I said, we'll hear from AJ Preller and Bob Melvin on Tuesday, and who knows how much we'll get from that, but hopefully enough.
Not much. Tidbits, not much.
Some nuggets to at least kind of frame the offseason and maybe give us some indication of what's ahead. But those guys are pretty good, especially AJ, at not giving us too much.
Yeah. A lot of comments, but not much insight.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is fair. Yeah. That's just how it goes. That's how it goes. It's a long, obviously early in the offseason, a lot to come. And so not going to show all your cards. Appreciate everybody processing the postseason with us. It's been a lot of fun doing these podcasts, you know, after games, between series, this or that. And it's been fun knowing that you folks are along the ride for us, and we'll keep it going, you know, during the off season, you know, regular Thursday pods and tracking whatever's going on in the months ahead.
Aaron Judge to San Diego.
That'd be nice. I'm sure there's going to be some Otani rumors and all that stuff.
There you go.
So there's always plenty to talk about with the Padres. And again, you can listen to your podcast app, watch on the NBC7 YouTube page, streaming app, NBC7.com sports wrap page. Football night in San Diego, Todd. That march is on. It is now football and coming up on college basketball, hockey season. The seasons have changed here in San Diego.
I just thought of, something. These are the last words I'm going to say of this podcast. Uh-oh. Just for fun. Tatis for Trout. Good night now.
No.